So how's the practice going today? Better, worse, different, same? Any comments or questions for today? Contract or...
Yeah, like you explained.
Sure.
But sometimes it was difficult for me to stop that, because when I tried only to rest in awareness, but it was still going on, and I tried to find out where the end maybe of this thing. I saw something, and then I thought, I don't know if it's possible.
You can do the expansion contraction the whole time if you want. I mean, it's a way of trying to balance between being too tight and too loose. So in the beginning phases, you can do quite a lot of that just so that you can find the right balance. And then in the instructions that we read from Padmasambhava, he introduced some questioning there. You know, like you said, where's the edge of the awareness or something? He introduced some questioning like that into the practice, which actually is a Vipassana practice. But because of that sort of questioning, your mind becomes very alert. So it can be also a way to help overcome dullness.
But okay, to stay with these questions or with this.
It's a Vipassana practice, but. Particularly if you find a bit of dullness, then you can do a little bit of questioning to really become attentive and alert, and then just drop the question eventually and just rest in that experience then. That's fine.
When you did this Dongdaemun practice today, I found that it's easier to free some people from smoke.
More difficult.
Why?
Why? Well, sometimes it depends on our relationship to the person. Of course, if the person is someone difficult, maybe we think, no, they sort of deserve to suffer, so I don't want to take it from them. Yeah. Or it could be that what you are imagining a smoke is something quite strong, like some serious disease or something. So you have not really wanting to take that serious thing yourself. So, the reason that you don't want to take, whether it's that or because you don't like the person or they don't deserve it or whatever, I mean, it's the self-cherishing mind, it's our selfish attitude that doesn't like to do that. So, the fact that we're sort of trying to do that is really helping to reduce our selfish mind, because the self-cherishing mind doesn't want to take any suffering from anybody, even our friends, really. I mean, if we're very, really selfish. So the fact that you're sort of trying to do that is really helped to reduce the self-cherishing. So that's very good. And why do you think that was the case? Why do you think you had difficulty for a loved one to take the smoke?
No, I don't know. It was so difficult. I just breathe, and the smoke doesn't disappear.
Maybe because the loved one is someone very important, and so if it's not someone important, then it's sort of, oh yeah, I can take that away, you know. But maybe because it's an important person, then it's really like, that's why it's maybe more difficult, because you really want to do that. Mm-hmm. But that's okay. You just keep going, keep persevering. That's fine.
Thank you. I'd like to comment on that, because I think that it depends a little bit on my relaxation or agitation and focus or non-focus.
Depends on how easy to take, or
yeah. If I can sort of see if that black just doesn't come out, if I eventually see it, why? Because that's where I'm going.
Sure.
Or not.
Sure. Now, with this practice, well, any sort of visualization practice, of course, it's sometimes people have difficulty visualizing the person clearly or the smoke clearly or whatever. As a beginner, it's not so important that we have everything crystal clear. The key element in this meditation is the willingness to take and the willingness to give. That's the key element. I mean, we can have crystal clear visualization and do it very mechanically and not really have some impact. Or the visualization can be sort of hazy and vague, but we really want to take that from them and we really want to give them happiness, and so that'll be more strong. So don't worry too much about the visualization if it's not so crystal clear and doesn't look exactly right. It's that willingness to take the suffering, the willingness to give them happiness, that's the key element in this practice. And then the visualization will, over time, of course, will become more and more clear as our mind becomes more stable and more clear. So that's okay.
Can it also be because in one situation it's harder to envision the necessary causes for this person to feel something, whereas it's easy to imagine how someone else would be feeling something because of their circumstances?
You mean the difficulty of taking it because it's some sort of problem that there's no easy cause to? Yeah. Yeah, again, we're not actually taking it, it's just the willingness to take it. But yes, that could be a reason, of course. You know, if it's some stubborn illness or something, we may think, oh, it's very hard to take that from them.
Not just because I don't want that illness.
Sure.
But also, it's just hard to imagine that illness.
So. Yeah, sure, that's right. That's what I meant as well, yes, that's true. Yeah. Oh, and one point that reminds me from earlier was when I was giving the example of the pain in the knee, and I said we should try to practice acceptance, not have aversion to any of our physical or mental suffering. And then, you know, Shanti Deva's advice of, you know, if a situation can be remedied, why get upset? If it can't be remedied, no point in getting upset. That doesn't mean that we should just sit with our suffering and try to go through it without remedying it. You know, like if we've got some problem with the knee, if the knee is damaged and there is some sensations there, yes, of course we can avoid the aversion. But if we understand that by continuing to sit in this posture, we're actually damaging the knee further, that would be really irresponsible. So we shouldn't do that. So there's a fine line between not reacting unnecessarily and magnifying suffering and not attending to some illness or injury. You know, sometimes people take that to very much an extreme in the Buddhist spiritual path in terms of purification. You know, they've got some serious illness and they go, oh, I don't need to go to the doctor, I'll just do some purification practice and get rid of my disease. So, you know, I think we need to be a little bit responsible in terms of that and not just think that we can just imagine for it to go. I mean, to do that, of course, is a good thing to do, but then also, if it is some serious problem, then I think we need to look after our body and, you know, check, go and see a medical practitioner if it's a serious problem. So that's just one thing I wanted to mention. Yeah.
Yeah, but I noticed sometimes that if it comes to breathe in, the black smoke, or to give up, then my breathing tends to change.
Change, yeah. You breathe so deeper.
Yeah, you want to kind of breathe deeper, so that...
Yeah, I mean, in this practice, that doesn't really matter so much, and we don't even have to combine it with the breath if we don't want to. I mean, we can just imagine doing this without conjoining it with the breath, but usually in the text, they conjoin it with the breath because it's said that it's easier to focus if you match it to the breath, it's easier to stay focused on the practice. But we don't have to do that. If you prefer just to take and give without connecting it to the breath, that's fine. And if you want to breathe a little bit deeper to do this practice, that's also okay, I think. So it's okay. People are identifying with their situation, and so, I mean, it's something familiar, and so even if it's suffering, they're still, that's them, you know, that's what they've identified with, and so that seems to be part of their nature, that's who they are, and so then they don't sometimes want to get rid of that because they've identified so heavily in that, that that's ingrained into their personality. And so this goes back to this idea of the cognitive fusion that we talked about the other day, you know, that we tend to identify ourselves with all of these things, not just physical illnesses, but with our thoughts and emotions and memories and our body and our illnesses and so forth, and we identify with that and we grasp onto that and we hold on to that very tightly, and often the things we identify with are very dysfunctional and harmful, but it seems like that's me, so if I let go of that, then I let go of me and then there's no me left. So again, we need to understand that we're none of these things, you know, we're not our thoughts, we're not our emotions, we're not our memories, we're not our illnesses, we're none of these things. These are things which we have, therefore we can change them. There is a me that has all these things and we can change all of these things. And if we stop identifying ourselves with these things, then we can understand we can change all of these things. And there was one more point I wanted to mention on that, but I've slipped my mind now. No, it's gone. Okay. Sorry? No. Anyway, it's gone.
Just to find more comments, I find it's very, 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 it sounds perhaps selfish, but it makes me feel very new.
Sure.
It's a kind of lick, and actually, 2 points, the thing that you mentioned that you suffer something. I've tried that before, so that you change it and do this kind of practice. So it really widens your perspective, and it's perfect.
Yeah.
And the other thing, this practice we did today, so I recognize that I was like, when the comb is ringing, because I want to still give the compassion to this and to this and this and this and this. I was like, in a hurry, and I was like, I knew it made everybody. They were doing this and this. So
that's very good. Yeah.
Really, I don't know how to express it in English, but took me.
And it is. It's very powerful. And you mentioned a point I think that's important is, you know, you said that, you know, we're doing it, giving and taking, and it makes us feel good,
yeah.
You know. And then people might think, oh, but that's being selfish, you know. Mm-hmm. But actually, and this is some advice that often His Holiness Dalai Lama gives to us Westerners, you know, often when he's giving a talk in some public place, you know, and we talk, and he talks also about a lot about, you know, giving up self-cherishing and cherishing others and being completely unselfish. And, you know, of course he understands that for us to be completely unselfish is a very difficult thing to do, you know, that we all, I mean, really to do any single one act in a completely unselfish way is all very, very, almost impossible. I mean, even to, you know, if we do think something that we think is unselfish, we're doing it for someone else, even at a very little level, we sort of expect them to say thank you, you know. If they don't, we get upset, you know. But I did all that thing for you, and you didn't even say thank you. So, you know, even at that level. So, therefore, to really eliminate self-cherishing 100% it's a thing that we'll need to work on for the rest of our life. But what we need to do is, of course, start where we are, and that is we tend to be very selfish, but we tend to be very selfish in a very dumb way, meaning anyone who gets in my way of my happiness, we harm them, and then, of course, they harm us back and big mess. So His Holiness Dalai Lama, he says, okay, if you have to be selfish, at least be selfish in a smart way. And the smart way to be selfish is to understand that our happiness is a little bit dependent on the people around us. So if we look after them, they're more likely to look after us. So at least that's one step better than what we do now. So therefore, if we do things for others, even with a very selfish motivation, hoping to get something in return, that's already something better than what probably we're already doing. And then if we just do that, you'll probably find over time that the joy we get from just doing something or giving to someone else will far outweigh of hoping to get anything in return, and then we'll become less and less selfish. So, because if we have this attitude that, you know, often then people do this, you know, they're going to do something good, but then they see they've got a completely selfish motivation for doing this help. They go, oh, I'm not doing it because it's selfish. I think that would be a mistake, because we wouldn't be able to really begin to do anything good without some level of selfishness. So rather, if we are going to do something and we notice the selfish motivation, try to reduce that as much as possible and still do that good act. And then you'll find over time you'll become less and less selfish. So that's where to start, with the smart selfishness. Because otherwise, sometimes, like even with this sort of practice, as you mentioned, people beat themselves up, you know, thinking, oh, I'm not supposed to feel good. It's supposed to be for the others. I better not do that. So that's okay. It's okay. Anything else from today, from practice? Yeah.
I wanted to ask when I start with some of the practice, can I switch to loving-kindness and
no, you can do in the same session, you can do the two if you want. It would, and both will work. I mean, if you did, like, you started with some shamatha, then of course your mind is hopefully more calm and clear and focused, which means when you do the tonglen, you'll be more focused. Or alternatively, if you really start with a tonglen and you really have that mind of loving kindness and compassion, that's a very powerful mind, a very energetic mind, and then you use that as the motivation or the basis for shamatha, then shamatha will work also very well. So both ways of doing them in the same session, it can be helpful, and you can even then switch around. So that's fine. That's fine to do like that. Yeah.
And sometimes I want to look around this mindfulness thing.
To look around, what do you mean?
How to say? Okay, I'm focused on my nostril.
Right.
But sometimes I go
Oh, you're trying to see the mindfulness. Then we're going into, that's a sort of Vipassana practice, because then you're, and that sometimes happens, that people, like, if they're observing the mind, then they go, oh, where's the observer? You know, where's this observer or witness? This is a Vipassana practice, and this is a valid thing to do in Vipassana practice, to investigate who is this observer or witness, or where is this mindfulness? So, but this is a Vipassana practice. Okay. So in shamatha, we don't want to go there, because then we're mixing practices. That's right. I mean, in Vipassana practice, part of that can be, you know, where is the mind, you know, or where is this, you know, where is the observer, and then investigate. But this is Vipassana practice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anything else anyone would like to bring up?
Yeah. Ask about the breath practice.
Sure.
Like occasionally when the concentration is quite good and you have the touch in your nostrils or the feeling, but then it happens that you can't kind of say that what is the direction of your breath.
Because it's getting very subtle?
Yeah, but then... is that important to try to focus the direction of the breath, or just that because it can, the feeling can be like an intensive long period, even hurting it.
Hurting?
Yes, like...
Yeah, I mean, I think you should just really stick to the sensations, because you're going to, I mean... When you do that, your breath really settles down, sometimes to the point where you can't hardly even notice your breathing. And, of course, then there are sensations here, even between the breaths. So you may not be able to really detect so much the difference between them, but you probably will find that as your clarity improves, you'll still be able to pick up that difference. But... don't worry about it. Just stay with those sensations.
Yeah, I don't know if it's correct the way to do this, but when the monkey mind and this cartoon already got a little bit not so funny anymore, and then I tried to freeze the thoughts, because they went some point. I understand when I'm a little bit agitated that I'm like playing a game, like a thought, like this.
Sure.
And so I one point I started to freeze this. It came out and I froze it for myself to see and let it go. And the next one is.
Yeah, I mean, particularly, as you said, if you're really very, a lot of thoughts and very, a lot of agitation, then this can be a way of giving ourselves a bit of space, because otherwise sometimes we get overwhelmed. So this is a little bit like this idea of labeling and noting to give ourselves a bit of space from the object. So I think this is okay in the beginning stages to do like this.
But the labeling and noting thing for me, it was very, very hard, because I started to do it and there are some impulses of the mental event which are actually empty itself. It's just impulse.
Yeah, it's not clear. Yeah.
And but I want to put some label.
Well, just put a label impulse.
Yeah, but already something points at maybe it's a little bit like spoon.
So again, what you're going to find is that as the mind becomes more stable and clear, a lot of this subtle mental activity that barely registers now, maybe some impulse or something, this will become slowly more and more evident and more clear over time. So that's okay. I mean, if it's just some sort of impulse or something vague, then if you want to give it a label, just give it a label of impulse or something. And as you really become more stable, clear, it becomes more and more clear. You'll be able to, there's two types of clarity here. One's called temporal clarity and I can't remember the other one. But basically, as the mind becomes more clear, you're going to not only pick up more subtle mental activity, but you're going to also pick up more brief mental activity. You're talking about actually the falling asleep process?
No, I can't. It becomes difficult to fall asleep. It's just like, I guess the mind. And I guess it's been there also before. Just that the mind was more dull, so I didn't even... I mean, it reminds me of sometimes also at home.
So you're talking just about now during the retreat?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, often... because our mind is quite alert, then this can happen when we're going to sleep. Our mind is still alert. And this can happen a bit too if we're a little bit too tight during the day. Then, of course, our mind is like a boiling water, you know, it's buzzing. So this can happen in the evening. So that's another reason to make sure that we really relax. But, of course, also, as the mind becomes more stable and clear, then as we're going through the falling asleep process, we can maintain the mindfulness as we're going deeper into. Normally, you know, because our mind is so sluggish and dull, then very early in the falling asleep process, it becomes unconscious. But, you know, we can, as it becomes more stable and clear, we can maintain awareness as we're going asleep. And even to the point where, if we really train well, we can maintain awareness right into deep sleep, which is called lucid sleep. This is possible.
So for me today, I feel like anxious quite a lot. So basically, my mindfulness when I'm in the object, it's okay. I'm in the course. Excitation, it's okay. I mean, but I can retain my thoughts, my mindfulness on the object. But parallel to it, there is an anxious feeling coming, boiling, and it's overwhelming sometimes. And I just stop meditating.
Mm-hmm. So again, maybe I think you're just being too tight here. So we need to relax.
But I'm trying.
Well, see, that's it. I want to relax. I got to relax.
I don't know. I feel like maybe there's some energy.
As well. This can happen as well.
I feel it kind of. I just feel it.
Yeah.
And this makes me, because in general, I'm very in tune with my body and any change within it makes me, I don't like it. Even if it's good or bad, I just don't like it. When it's something inside happening, I don't know what it is. I don't like it. So for me now, I really don't like it.
So I would recommend just to relax more. And you will also, of course, even if we're relaxed, and we become more stable, clear, we will start to notice much more subtle movements of energy in our body that we've never noticed before.
But
that as well.
But it's suffocating, you know? It's like, heaviness.
Yeah, then you're just too tight, I think. So just relax.
But at the same time, I can easily focus without. I mean, parallel. Those two things are going parallel.
Sure.
I don't, as if they make me more aware. Like the dullness disappear because of this anxiousness.
Yeah.
Because it makes me very, very alert.
Yeah.
But at the same time,
sure.
Because I'm, let's say, if I decide to persist with this, my object, but at the same time, this anxiousness is just starts to bow, and sometimes when it becomes overwhelmed, I just drop it.
Yeah. So again, it's the same in daily life. You know, we can get, if we have a lot of adrenaline going, well, that's what I mean. It's the same thing. It's the fight or flight. It's like pump up the adrenaline so that we can be completely focused, which is okay when we're in danger. You know, that adrenaline can really keep us super focused for a very short time to see clearly exactly what to do. So that's okay in the survival mode. But of course, when we're sitting and meditating for half an hour and pumping adrenaline, that's
so what do I do? Because I read that sometimes there is this spiritual emergencies that could happen, and that's not good.
No. So like I said, just relax. Really, just relax. Just relax. Don't.
So nothing so kind of chaotic can take place.
I mean, if you notice that sort of tension there, just relax, 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 relax.
Yeah, that's all I can do.
If you, what object are you using?
Today I'm changing them because.
Oh, okay.
But in general, I was doing the nostrils, but today I'm doing more the abdominal. Because in the morning I did this with the Buddha nature, but you said it's not good, and then it came to my mind, maybe I should stop with it.
Yeah.
So mainly abdominal.
Yeah, I would stick down, stay low. Don't go here if you've got that adrenaline because that's easy for it to come up if we're elevating the focus in more subtle objects. So I would recommend either the full body or stay on the abdomen and just really relax, just relax.
And at some point when it became a bit overwhelmed, I was just listening to the sound of the trees.
Yeah, and so you could do that.
Still focused,
on
the trees.
Yeah, that you could do that if you wanted. You could just switch to listening to sound for some time.
Okay.
And the birds and so forth.
That's basic.
Chill, yes, relax. Yeah.
Concerning the being really tight and hard to relax, I was struggling really the first 3-4 days to the point when somebody mentioned that beginners sometimes have issues with heartbeats, and the next day I had most of the day raging.
After
that day, I decided, okay, I'm taking this retreat as a vacation.
Yes.
And just enjoying the time.
Exactly.
And since that attitude change, it all has become a lot easier.
That's it. That's right. I mean, I think I've mentioned a couple of times this, you know, I've got to use my time here. Push, 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 push. And I mean, it's really just counterproductive. So, yes, I mean, vacation. Let's have a vacation. Let's relax. And then just learn these techniques and chill. Perfect. Perfect. No, and it goes a lot better, doesn't it? Very good, very good. Okay, so let's have a holiday now then for 25 minutes. Have a vacation and relax.
Image of Hawaii.
Sorry?
Image of Hawaii.
Yes. Focus on the beach. as an act of loving kindness for yourself, allow your awareness to descend into the body. Use the out-breath to relax and release any tightness or tension in any part of the body. Imagining a wave of relaxation slowly moving through the body. Relaxing every single muscle in the body. And relaxing more deeply with each out-breath. Setting the mind in a state of ease and relaxation. Simply bringing it into the present moment. Focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. Now shift your attention to your chosen object of meditation. And focus on it in a very relaxed way.